Hey, good morning. Next talk today is going to be done by Werner Fischer. He studied computer science and media security in Hagenberg in Austria, and he has been working with Linux clusters since 2002. Before his current job as a cluster development guy at Thomas Krenn, he worked for 2 years at IBM, and today we'll be talking about virtualization and clustering, high availability, and what the pitfalls and the possibilities are. So, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for the introduction. Welcome everybody to the talk about high availability clustering in of virtual machines, possibilities and pitfalls. My name is, as mentioned, Werner Fischer, and as you can imagine, I'm working in the cluster area, so we have often to do with active and passive systems, where we have a second system that acts as a failover protection in case if somebody breaks on the first system. And as I'm here at LinuxTag since Tuesday, meanwhile, and kept speaking all day at the booth for some days, my voice should be well enough, but if it breaks, if me, the active speaker, breaks, we have a passive speaker here. My colleague Christoph Mitasch, who has also worked on this paper and on this talk. So, yeah, we are somehow clustered in all of our aspects of our lives. Okay. Yeah, that's the agenda of today. We have four main topics for the next 40 minutes. First of all, I'll give some introduction about possible problems in virtualized environments. To get some idea why we should think about clustering in virtualized environments. Then, in the second part of the talk, I'll give a short introduction about different types of virtualization techniques that are around today and that can be used in Linux environments. The third part, HA cluster configurations in virtual environments, is the main part where we'll look into the possible configurations and how they fit in the different areas of virtualization techniques. And last but not least, I'll show you some concrete examples how you can implement clustering in a virtualized environment. So, problems of virtualization. As you can see on the slide, we have two setups here. The first is a traditional setup without any kind of virtualization. It's a small company, or maybe also a bigger company, which has four servers running in a data center. There's a web server, a database server, a mail server, and a file server. Today, often people think about virtualization. It's a very popular topic these days. And as you can see in setup B, we have a new hardware machine which has power enough to fulfill all the four things that we have on four machines at previous times. So we use a single server for our web server, database, mail and file server, as we are running four virtual machines on that physical machine. So far, so good. But the really interesting question is, what's the difference between one physical server failing in setup A and one physical server failing in setup B? Yeah, the bad answer is that in setup B, actually, four virtual servers are down, so the stress for the IT administrator might be a little bit more. Okay. I found some nice information from James Bottomley at the Linux World Magazine. He is one of the development leads of a Linux clustering solution. And I think the thing he said is very important for these things. He says, by combining virtualization and HA clustering, it is possible to benefit from the increased manageability and the savings from server consolidation through virtualization, but without decreasing the uptime of the critical services. This is a thing which is often overlooked these days, and yeah, this points out the problem in one sentence very well. Okay, let's take a look at different types of virtualization techniques that are around today. We've chosen to categorize the virtualization techniques into these three areas for the purpose of this talk. Of course, there are also other possible criteria which you could take to differentiate between virtualization techniques, but for the clustering aspect, this thing is very well suited. First of all, the first thing we have on the slide, hardware virtualization, like you could do with QEMU under Linux, or maybe you could also, or VMware. Hardware virtualization provides, as the name says, virtual hardware. This has some great benefits. The guest operating systems can run without any modifications. You are able to run different operating systems in the virtual machines. You can run Linux, BSD stuff, or if you want to, you could also run Windows, if you want to. yeah, and it's around for a while. But yeah, you have virtual hardware, you have a kernel on the base system, you have different kernels in the operating system, and although you have this great flexibility of running different operating systems in the guests, you might have some overhead in the whole stack. The second type, paravirtualization, also really popular today, also because of Xen, which there will be also talk about later on, I think, at 1 p.m. Or Denali, or yeah, you could also say that user mode Linux is some kind of paravirtualization, but I've put it in here. Today, guest operating systems, the kernels, need modifications when you want to run them in the virtual machine. In the future, when we have new features in the processors, it will be also possible to run operating systems without any modifications. And the benefit in this kind of virtualization is that you could do some steps to improve the whole virtualization and the communication between the host and the guest to get a better performance. And although today you need to modify the kernels in the guests and also on the base system, there are no needs of changing the application binary interface. So the applications you run on the virtual machines don't have to be modified. So it's also very usable and a very good thing. Yeah, and the third type of virtualization, which I have here on the slide, is called operating system virtualization. Examples are under Linux, the Open Reset project, or Linux ReServer, which both of them have booths on the Linux talks. So if you have some detailed questions on these technologies, you can go to their booths. Under Solaris, you have, for example, the Solaris containers, which have also which are also some kind of operating system virtualization. The main thing is that with this kind of virtualization, you only have one single kernel running for both the host and all the guest operating systems. So, for example, if you want to read a file in a virtual machine, you give the read, the syscall, to the kernel, and the kernel can directly serve your read requests. When you're running hardware virtualization or power virtualization, the syscall goes to the kernel in the guest, has then to be forwarded to the host, which reads the file and handles it back to the guest, and then the guest kernel handles it back to the process which wants to read the file. So in some situation, this causes, of course, some overhead. And if you can live with the fact that when you're using operating system virtualization, you can also only run a Linux guests or Sun Solaris guests, depending on the kind of operating system you're running on the base machine. If you can live with that, you could benefit from that, and so you can be very resource efficient. And also one big advantage is that the guests can be booted within some seconds. As the kernel is already running, you only have to do a very small amount of things when you want to boot the virtual machine. And so it takes only seconds instead of the normal boot time you have when you're booting a physical machine or you're booting a virtual machine in a power virtualized or hardware virtualized environment. So, there we are at the main part of this talk, possible HA cluster configurations in virtual environments. And we'll look together at these five possible configuration scenarios from A to E. As you can see, we have always two parts here. The first part is the active machine. The second part is the passive machine. So we'll look at two node clusters with an active node and a passive node. We do this because most of the clusters are, in fact, two node clusters. And if you want to have a failover, it often is the best that you have a machine that does nothing normally when you want to fail over there, because if you are running, for example, an active-active configuration, it could be that, for example, when you're running Apache web server on the first machine and the MySQL on the second machine, and you say, oh, I have a better hardware utilization, and in case of a failover, both of them run on one machine, you could run into problems because as the load gets higher and higher, it might happen that the web server needs a machine itself, the MySQL server needs a machine itself. And when you have a failover, you don't have enough memory and stuff, and then everything is so slow that the cluster doesn't help you. So it's most of the time the best thing to use an active and a passive machine. So the five scenarios are the first, virtual. That means we build a cluster between a virtual machine and another virtual machine, both of them running on a single physical machine. The second is the same scenario, but the virtual machines are running on different physical machines. The third one shows a configuration where the active node normally runs on a physical machine, while the passive node is running as a virtual machine on another host. The fourth is nearly the same as the third one, but with switched roles. And finally, I'll show you a configuration where I built the cluster at the host system, so you have the cluster between a physical machine and another physical machine. And in case of a failure or a switchover, you fail over all virtual machines that are running in the virtualization engine. We'll also look at possible pitfalls and what the future can bring us and perhaps should bring us. Okay, first scenario, virtual machine, on a single physical machine. As you can see, it does not protect against any hardware failure, so you have a single point of failure in this configuration. The only advantage you could take out is that when you're using hardware or power virtualization and you're running your own kernel in the virtual machine, it can protect you against the kernel panic in a virtual machine. So in case of a kernel panic, you could do a failover. But it depends. Kernel panics don't happen that often. And if they do, I think you have to look at the cause of this. And it might not be very useful in a production environment. But in fact, it can be used in a test environment. For example, if you're developing on a clustering solution or if you're developing on some kind of data replication, it's very usable when you have only one machine and you could test your development things on there, and you don't have to buy another machine. So the second scenario is nearly the same, but you have the virtual machines running on different physical machines. So now you don't have the single point of failure anymore. You are protected against hardware failures, and although you are running the cluster between two different machines, you could benefit from an easier management of cluster nodes through some things you get out of the virtualization technique, as it can be you have easier procedures for backup and recovery things, and you want to have these advantages. Another advantage is that you can run multiple instances of an application that normally cannot run multiple times on a single operating system. So if you have, for example, an application you need 3 or 4 times, and normally you can run it only once on an operating system, you could build 4 virtual machines and can then build the cluster as you would do it when you have only one. In the third configuration, you have an example with a cluster between a physical machine as active node and a virtual machine as the passive node. This allows you to save hardware as you can use one single physical machine as some kind of a passive node appliance for multiple clusters. So if you're running multiple two-node clusters and you don't want to spend money on many passive machines, you could consolidate them onto one machine, do a virtualization there, and when something happens on an active machine, you can fail over there. Of course, you have to consider that whether or not it might happen that all active machines break at the same time, because when all the clusters fail over to the one physical machine, you have to ensure that you have enough system resources there. And it's also useful, again, when you have hardware virtualization or power virtualization, and you have clusters that are running on different operating systems, you could also use that in this configuration, because it's no problem to have different operating systems in the virtual machines, and then you have also the benefits that you only need one machine for multiple clusters as a passive node. So it's kind of useful to save costs there. Fourth scenario, virtual machine to physical machine. There you run all the active nodes on some kind of active node appliance that you size large enough, and you use smaller machines for the passive nodes. I'm not sure how useful this configuration might be, but I've put it in for the reason of completeness. Some people say that you could use this in a configuration where you have multiple old machines and you want to use them somehow, and you still want to build a cluster, but you only want to buy one new powerful machine. But I think if you want to use older machines that might not be powerful enough as a passive node, I'm not sure if someone should do that in an HA environment, because although you have a passive node, this passive node itself should be as redundant in itself as possible, because it makes no sense when you have a passive node and then it has only one power supply or no weight in there. It doesn't make sense. It's better to use only one machine and size this one machine big enough, have weight in there, have multiple power supplies in there, and don't use a cluster. Okay, the fifth and last configuration I've in the slides is a cluster between two physical machines. And as you can see now, the cluster manager is running within the physical machine. It's running in there below the virtualization layer. At all the four scenarios we had before, when the cluster manager was running with a virtualized machine, the cluster manager was running within the virtual machine. So that's the main difference we have here. It's an advantage that it's a very simple cluster configuration, as you have only one HA resource you configure in your cluster manager. That's the virtualization engine itself. And you don't have the need of cluster-specific changes for high available applications. And it's very well suited when you are using operating system virtualization, because when you have a failover of the whole virtualization engine, you have to boot all the virtual machines at the passive or at the former passive node. So with operating system virtualization, you can boot these machines very fast, and so you can also have a short failover time, although you might have a big number of virtual machines. The point, no need of cluster-specific changes, we'll go into that detail at one of the examples, where I'll show you what these benefits really are. What are possible pitfalls when you're using cluster managers in virtualized environments? The main thing is that most of the HA clustering solutions that are around today have not been built with virtualization in mind. So you have to take care when you're using a cluster manager, when you choose your cluster manager, how well it suits with the kind of virtualization you want to do and where possible pitfalls might be. One thing is especially the shared resource protection mechanisms that can cause troubles. In a cluster environment, you use such mechanisms when you have shared resources like a shared storage to ensure that only one single machine or one single server gets access to a machine, because, for example, if you have a shared storage system in a SAN and both nodes want to get up because the cluster communication is interrupted and you have a split brain situation, when both nodes start mounting the file system and you don't have a clustered file system, the file system will break and all the data will be destroyed. So there are some kind of clustering scenarios when you are really dependent on such shared resource protection mechanisms. It might be that when you're using other techniques for getting the data access on the nodes, if you are using, for example, some kind of data replication, where you mirror the data between the two nodes and you don't have a shared storage, that you don't need such a shared resource protection. For example, if you're using DRBD for data replication, you are not enforced to use a shared resource protection. But when you're having a SAN or some other resources that must be protected, you'll have to look into these things. And there you have, depending on the cluster manager, different possibilities how you can do that. One thing is you could use something that is called resource fencing. This is often done via SCSI 2 or SCSI 3 reservations when you're having a shared storage system. That means if you're accessing this shared storage device, you put a SCSI reservation on that device and the other node cannot access it because it doesn't have the SCSI reservation. Other cluster managers, for example, like Heartbeat or also the Reddit Cluster Suite, are using a node fencing mechanism. This works in a way that they are using a technique called stun it, which means shoot the other node in the head. If you have two nodes, the passive node gets no heartbeats, no data from the active node, and thinks, oh, the active node is dead. I want to mount the file system in the SAN. He only thinks that the other node is dead. It could also be that only all the communication paths are interrupted. So it's only an assumption, but it's not for sure. So when you're having such a configuration, you configure the nodes with an access to a power switch, and when the passive node detects that the active node doesn't send any messages anymore, he first shoots the active machine and interrupts the power for the active node, so he can be sure that the active or former active node doesn't have any access to data anymore. And in fact, this can cause troubles when you are using these technologies in a virtualized environment. For example, if you are running your cluster between virtual machines and you implement this with StarNet, you don't want to shoot all the other machines which maybe are running fine. And it's very important to remember the first key HA principle, which is simplicity, and to ensure that you don't build a very great cluster system, but at the end of the day, someone cannot understand it when he sees it, and you are very error prone when you want to use the thing. So it's better to keep it simple and to try to avoid these things if possible. So, what could be there in the future? The combination of virtualization and HA clustering is just in its beginning stages at the moment. So we can expect that as virtualization gets more and more popular these days, more and more people will think about what happens when a machine fails and all the virtual machines are down. So I personally think that there will be more information, more solutions, and more implementations in the future, because it's getting more and more important when more and more people use virtualization. Another thing is that a technique called real-time migration or zero-downtime migration is currently getting very popular in the virtualization area. You have such mechanisms, for example, today in Xen or also in OpenVSAT. We have the possibility, when you're running multiple servers with virtualization, that you can move a virtual machine from one server to another server while preserving all the memory, the processes, and network connections. So you don't have a downtime when you do this. You only have a short interruption of services for a second or so. This is getting very popular in virtualization, and I think that this feature could be also used for a switch over in an HA cluster. That means when you want to switch the machine from one to another for maintenance purposes, for example. Today, when you have in a cluster solution and you do a manual switch over, normally you stop all the services on the active node and the service will be started on the other node, but you don't preserve memory, processes, and network connections. So I think there could be some ways how to implement this feature for a kind of for these switchover scenarios. Actually, I'm not sure, but perhaps some of these ideas could be also used for failover situations. I'm not sure about that, because when a machine fails, you're losing all your memory and processes and network connections. But I don't know, maybe has an idea how to give this information all the time somewhere in the storage, and when a failover situation occurs, to read some of this information to have a better or a faster failover. Actually, I'm not kernel developer, I'm not sure, but maybe some of these ideas could be used. So, still in time, I'll show you some concrete examples. This example here is a cluster built with OpenVSAT, Heartbeat, and DRBD. You see, we have two hardware nodes, node 1 and node 2, where we are running an operating system. When we tried that at our site, we used CentOS. It could be any Linux distribution. We configured the cluster manager Heartbeat for managing the highly available resources. And we used the data replication DRBD, which is some kind of RAID 1 mirroring over the network. That means if we write something on a file system here, we write it actually on the DRBD block device, and DRBD ensures that the data is written on both the local RAID here and the local RAID here. So we can mirror all our data, and we don't have to buy an expensive shared storage solution, and can save money. Yeah, as mentioned before, I'll give you a hint about the advantage we have when we're using virtualization with this kind of cluster. When you are running a cluster without virtualization, for example, when you think that this virtualization layer isn't present here and you're instead running directly Apache, MySQL, and so on the cluster. Of course, you can use the DRBD for mirroring, and you can put your data, your databases on DRBD, your websites on DRBD, but you cannot put the configuration directory /etc, for example, on the DRBD device, because the etc directory is needed by both nodes themselves, so you cannot do that. So today, you have the possibility to somehow manually synchronize the configuration files and stuff, or move the configuration files to the mirrored DRBD device and put symbolic links to the original location. But the problem you have is you have to do this for every application, and it is different for every application. And you have another issue that it might happen that your packet management isn't aware of these links, for example. So we had, for example, a situation where we had a cluster running MySQL, and when we updated MySQL because of a security issue, these links were removed, and the packet manager said, oh, there shouldn't be a link, there should be a configuration file or a directory, and simply inserted the default configuration, which was not the thing that we wanted. So when you're using virtualization in this configuration, and you have the possibility to mirror the whole virtual machine, including the etc directory, for example, so you have the whole file system of the virtual machine mirrored, you don't have to take care about that, because when you have a failover situation, yeah, you have all the configuration files on the passive node, and you don't have to look into the package management, how it will handle when you're inserting symbolic links in there. So it's really much more easier to do this in such a way as you would it be when you're using no virtualization. The one thing you have one drawback, that some cluster managers allow you to also monitor not only the hardware and the other node, but also allow you to monitor the applications. So if, for example, your web server crashes, but the machine is still okay, the cluster manager can recognize this and can try to restart the web server to ensure that it's available again. As we don't have cluster resources configured, for example, for a web server that might be running in a virtual machine here, this wouldn't be recognized by the cluster manager. So you cannot do this in this configuration. But still, there are people saying you should do, or it's a good thing to monitor also the applications, because then you can automatically restart them when they crash for some reason. The other thing is that some people think that, especially in Linux, when there's a crash of a server application, this has some reason why this happens, and you don't really solve the problem when you just restart the application. Most of the time there's some configuration error or some other problem which you should look into and ensure that the problem doesn't exist anymore, to be sure that this problem doesn't arise again. And when you simply restart your server when it fails, you don't know what it causes, and perhaps you might not notice it. So some people are thinking it is better to not to automatically restart the application when the server application crashes. But yeah, it depends on your needs. And one thing which might be desirable is to have some kind of external monitoring device, like you could do, for example, with Nagios, to do the other monitoring and give you an alert when something fails, and then you can look into why this crash might have happened. Okay, actually, we have also one of the main DRBD developers with us today. And so if you have some questions about DRBD, you can also ask them after the talk. Some other examples. You also find the URLs in the paper, which is on the Linux Talk DVD. Nearly the same as we had on the slide before, a cluster with Heartbeat and DRBD, but Linux vServer. It's also mentioned there how you can build that step by step. And it's nearly the same that on the slide before, because the technique between Linux Reserve and OpenVSet is very, very similar. So from a technical point of view, it's the same. Two other examples, one with the Red Hat Cluster Suite inside XamGuest of one of people of Red Hat. And another interesting thing, which was posted on the Heartbeat mailing list in March, was a resource agent for Xen guests in a Heartbeat 2.x environment. When you're looking at commercial virtualization techniques, you'll find that the clustering topic is getting more and more popular also in there, but today you don't have all the possibilities of clustering configuration as I showed on the slides, as also the commercial solutions are beginning to implement these things. Yeah, so what I've been talking about today. First of all, we looked into the problems of virtualization. The main issue here is that when you're running multiple virtual servers on a single physical machine, and this single physical machine breaks, you will have multiple servers down. Types of virtualization, the three types: hardware virtualization, power virtualization, and operating system virtualization. And then in the third part of the talk, we will look into five possible cluster configuration in a virtual environment, also with the possible pitfalls on the future. And yeah, at the end, we had some examples. So, 38 minutes of my talk are over. I'm pretty good in time, I think. So, I will like to thank you for your interest in this topic. It's really great that so many of you are here. I hope it was interesting for you, that you can take some of the information out here. I'd also like to thank Thomas Gren for letting Christoph and me working on this talk and on the paper at work, because it took several weeks. And yeah, if you have any questions, please ask.
Can we get the presentation at your site or somewhere?
For sure. I think there is a link on the Linux Talk DVD where updated presentation material will be posted. So I will send this in, and I will also put the slides on our company website and also on my private website. So you could drop me a mail if you don't find the URL, but I think it should be on the Linux Talk site.
Any other questions? Okay, I got one. Which file system are you running on top of YRDB?
You can run different file systems on top of YRDB. Actually, in this example, we are using ext3, but I think we could ask Lars, which is also with us, what file system should be used in when you're using YRDB. I think there's also a second microphone here, there.
Yeah, my name is Lars Ellenberg. I'm one of the core developers of DRBD. We tend to use ext3 on smaller file systems. Since XFS has stabilized now, we tend to use that because of the online grow feature. So you can say you have a 1 terabyte file system and you recognize it is not enough. You have strategic monitoring in place which indicates that in 3 or 4 weeks or something you hit the limit. You buy two other storage external storage boxes and you plug them in. You create you can take down the secondary node, you can do the hardware upgrade there, you take it up again, you extend your logical volumes, you can do a failover, you still have no downtime, you do the hardware upgrade on the other node, you extend the logical volumes there, you can extend the DRBD, you do an XFS GrowFS, and there you are and have 3 terabyte file system again, which is like to 30% full now instead of 95 or something. So you can do that all online without downtime. And the only file system you can do that in Linux, to my knowledge, is XFS. So since this has stabilized in the nowadays 2.6 kernel, yeah, we tend to recommend that for larger installations.
Any other questions? Okay.
In this example, you are using a synchronous replication to the other side. Is there a performance loss? And what about data integrity if a node 1 fails? And is there a mechanism to replicate or to synchronize back node 1 if it is repaired?
Yes. Actually, I think, again, perhaps Lars should answer this question because he's the developer, so I don't want to take the words out of his mouth.
The question was, again, how we replicate when a node comes back after failure.
And how's the performance impact when we're using DRPD, when we have to mirror it to the other side?
And right. Okay. So the answer is you can configure that. Well, what you actually can configure is the upper limit, which is used for DRBD replication during resynchronization. During normal operation, you cannot. There is no use for an upper limit because we are synchronous. I mean, every write is synchronous on both nodes, so you cannot place an upper limit or you don't want to. During resynchronization, you can and should place an upper limit for the resync operations because you have typically concurrent application requests during the resynchronization, so you want to limit the bandwidth, and you should limit that to say 30 or 50% of available I/O bandwidth, so you the rest is spared for your applications.
In fact, during normal operations, for example, we have set up this with two servers, both of them are running await one, a hard await one. And we got about, I think, 51 or 52 megabytes per second. We tried this with DRBD and we got, I think, 49 megabytes per second. So the impact during normal operation, also with synchronous writes, is really very, very low. We used here gigabit Ethernet. And on a DRBD mailing list, you also find examples where people are running a RAID system, a RAID 5 with 12 disks, for example, and they're writing and they are getting 130 megabyte per second where the Ethernet ends.
So yesterday some of us heard this exciting talk about Oracle File System, and I was wondering myself where you see OCFS, whether it is competitive to DRBD and XFS2. Do you have any experience in your business?
Actually, in our business, as we are mainly a hardware vendor, we are starting to work in the cluster area. We don't have use cases today in our business, but this might be different in other businesses. Actually, when you're using OCFS and you have a clustered file system, normally you will need to have a shared storage system. But it's also very interesting that, in fact, DRBD is again developing, and there is DRBD version 8 in development, where it will be possible to have a primary configurations to allow read and writes on both nodes, and you could use a clustered file system with data replication. It's an amazing idea, and I think Lars has some more information about that again, as he's the developer of this.
So actually, it is not that it will be possible. It is possible. The downside is we are still in beta phase, so there are still bugs hidden in DRBD 8. But the good story is it is actually working with OCFS. We have shared disk semantics. We have still some problems. We probably forgot to register some I/O controls for the poor guys who live in a 64-bit kernel environment with 32-bit user space. We just forgot those, but yeah, that will all be fixed. We still are in DRBD 8 pre-3 or pre-4 release, but when we come to the actual release of DRBD 8, this gives you shared disk semantics.
Any time frame on that?
Couple of months.
I have two more questions about DRBD. one is about...
Maybe I should just come in front of you.
Okay. Okay. One is it possible that you have a file system with Unix write semantic, which means if one node does a write and the write returns to the user land, that the other nodes see this write? Is this currently possible?
This is possible with DRBD8 and OCFS, yes.
And another one is, are there any other file systems available which give the possibility with two writing nodes?
We have GFS and the variations of those. We at Linbit did not yet really try those because they are still not in the kernel. I mean, DRBD is not in the kernel either, but I mean, we know what we are doing with DRBD, and we don't exactly know what we are doing with all those cluster file systems. I think we have four working variations of cluster file systems for Linux, meanwhile. They should all work, yeah. The interesting problem you get with cluster file systems and an HA setup for failover situations is you have different layers of membership. So you have the membership notion of your cluster file system. You have the membership notion of your cluster manager, which might be Heartbeat or anything else. If you use DRBD in the shared disk semantic way, obviously DRBD has its own notion of the membership, whether it sees its peer or not. So they should all agree upon what they see, and that will turn out to be a problem and has to be integrated in some way. But yeah, there are no ready-made solutions yet.
Okay, any other, maybe non-DRDB questions? Nobody? Okay, thank you, Werner. The next talk will be in about 10 minutes, so please stay around.
Thanks.